Real 12. We were talking about the importance of letters, letter contact with home.
Yes.
You say that it enabled them to let you know you were alive. What sort of thing could you write about? I mean, or was it just...
It was just general weather conditions and things like that, and that you were keeping fairly well. You were very limited in what you would say. You had to be very careful that you didn't, as it were, give anything away in case they should be caught and trumpeted to the enemy. But in the main, it was just general weather conditions, that you were all right, that you were eating and you were getting food and so on. If you knew anybody else, friends, that they were all right, we had no casualties and things like that. You were able to sort of respond to their letter. You were saying, oh, I was all right and so on. And your brothers and sisters hoped that they'd hearing from my brothers in the airport, hoped that he was all right to see. Things like that.
Would you get parcels as well?
Yes, occasionally, but they were not normally brought up in rest periods unless you had the echelon nearby. The echelon was the soft vehicle at the back which brought up all your kit and parcels and all the writing materials and things like that. That was the echelon.
And what would you get in parcels, or what would you want?
Well, another pair of socks and things like that, and maybe a bar of chocolate. Maybe a bit sticky when you got it, but a few sweets or things of that nature. You didn't get a great deal of weather food, because obviously they were on rations at home, you see, and we didn't expect that. But it was just a case of a few sweets, letters mainly, cuttings from newspapers that they thought we might be interested in, from people that we knew, possibly in the forces who'd been killed if they were in papers, loads of papers at home, and bits of information like that. It also gave us a chance to get hold of the local forces papers and read those, because there wasn't much time when you were moving in action. But in the rest period, you'd be able to just sit down on the ground and read the local forces papers.
What did you think of the forces newspapers? Because some people were a bit cynical about them, but what did you think of them?
Well, I thought they were quite reasonable. The one that always amused us was the photograph of our squadron headquarters tanks in Narni, with all the female population covering the tanks, and we'd been ordered to go through. We didn't have to stop and have the girls come out of tanks, but my driver said we didn't trust it in this world, and look at that lot. you know, they were quite humorous at the time, that character in my troop. But that was the sort of thing. The papers I found were quite interesting. They gave you a brief outline of what was going on. But there again, of course, you've got to be very careful that no information could be picked up by the enemy if they came across these papers. So there wasn't anything that you might call of secretive nature. But there was general information of what was going on in the rear areas. And it was something to read.
Would the men... have a drink, or would you have a drink?
Well, no.
I mean, would there be any chance, like Estaminets in the First World War, any local cafes or things? You know?
Very seldom, because tanks were never harboured where there were cafes. We were always in open areas. Unlike infantry, where you could go into houses and things, tanks, unless you were into ruined villages, you were normally in an area away from villages, so that you could guard your tanks, that was the thing. There might be a town nearby, but there, depending how far it was, there would be no leave partners in there. It depended how long you were due to stay in your rest area for.
So you didn't get much contact with the local Italians then?
Very little, except in farms and things like that. You might, if there was a farm nearby, you might wander down and barter for some eggs and things. But there was very little contact.
And anything else about rest periods you'd recall?
We very often got shelled, and I often used to wonder whether the Germans knew of the area, because obviously they'd retreated over that area, and whether they knew it would be a suitable harbour area for armour. But we often got shelled. Or sometimes I wondered if local Italians spotted us and passed information over. sometimes we had to move it. We've got rather good after shelling, and I've never realised it. And suddenly, salvo shelling would come down, and you might have to pack up and move to another area.
Now, the next thing, I think, is the advance on to Perugia, around about 17th, 18th of June.
Yes.
What you this is one point where you've got a story about an officer that didn't do too well, a new officer.
That's right, yes. Can I just go back onto the Narni episode? Because 50 years on, those of us who entered Narni became honorary citizens of Narni 50 years on, which is quite an attempt. I've got a certificate to prove it. Yes. Now, this was a rather sad occasion in a way. This was a young chap who came. He was a new second lieutenant posted to the regiment, and he was given to me as a troop corporal for battle experience. We were moving up to Perugia, and we were on the west of Perugia. We were ordered to an area of scrub and trees, and it was a rather unpleasant area where German infantry could hide behind trees with pierced anti-tank weapons and knock you out. There had been enemy activity reported there, and that's why we were sent. My troop was sent over to this left area and to check for enemy. We got there, and we didn't see any enemy at all. There was no firing at us. I ordered my corporal to go way to the left, on the left flank, and face the sort of trees and scrub. I went forward onto a ridge to look out over forward, the northern side where I considered the enemy the most likely. My sergeant came up with me on my right flank to keep an eye over to the right flank so that we got all round firing positions. Well, I was watching forward, and there was a little bit of shelling, but not much coming over. But nothing, it was harassing rather than being directly aimed at. And then suddenly, after we'd been there a little while, over from my left, I had the machine guns of the corporal's tank firing. And I looked, I couldn't see anything. And they were really belting away. So I said, what's going on? Can you see infantry? I think so. It was the young troop leader who came on to me. I think so. I said, have you seen any? He said, well, I think I have seen some. He said, we're firing into the trees. I said, yes, I know that. I said, well, cease fire. And I said, put your corporal on. The corporal, whose tank it was, came on to me, and he was acting as loader so that he would be there in case of problem. I said, look, have you seen any enemy? Why are you firing? He said, no, I'm afraid we haven't. We did say we haven't seen anybody, and we were ordered to fire into the trees. I said, well, that's fair enough. We did what we were ordered to do. But I said, don't fire unless you see anybody in the trees, or you are fired on yourself. I said, we can give your position away. So, nothing happened for a few minutes. And I looked over and I couldn't see any sign of this character at all. His flanks were down. But there was no more firing there. And we suddenly started to get shells coming over. And they were deliberately aiming at us. They knew our position. There was quite no doubt about that. Quite heavy firing to begin with. Then it eased off a bit. It came again. And the rate of fire doubled, and then it trebled. It really was what we call a good stunk, coming down by the dozen. And I looked at my corporal's tank. There was no sign of any life at all. He's got his turret hatched down, but there was no firing. And this was going on, going mad. Shells were coming over the whole time. And yet we couldn't see a thing to fire at. It was a miserable wet day. And again, suddenly, my sergeant came up, muttering something quite unintelligible. Now, I knew him. He had shell shock in North Africa. And I got at the back of my mind, I hope it wouldn't affect him, the absolute hail of shells. His wireless came on and said, Sergeant Bomb Officer, you've been like this before? I said, yes, I know. He said, there's only one way to get him out of it. Pardon me, I said, hopeless, no chance at the moment. Fortunately, the shelling eased a little bit and he sort of calmed down. But he was in no state, really, to do very much. So we have to be very careful and not get involved too deeply. But as I say, we couldn't see anything, so I hoped that the shell rate of fire would stop him. Fortunately, it did, because they didn't prevent him. Had they have hit somebody and there'd been a fire, we'd have had the whole of the battery helping us. They'd not hit anything, so they started to stop him. Well, we were ordered to stay there and hold our position, which we did. When the fire started, we told the officer, how about a cup of tea? Oh, it was right, get a cup of brewing, and they were past masters of it. Got a cup of tea brewing, had a cup of tea. Back in the tanks, there was only one tea, a water container that was 50 years old, it was especially with shrapnel. We had a cup of tea. And then we were ordered to retire. Well, in the retiring stage, I ordered my sergeant first and then my corporal, and I followed in the rear. And as my corporal went past me, I could see my driver with his head out. Not my dog, the corporal's driver with his head out. And the turret hatch closed so the officer wasn't watching. I'll have a word with him when we get back. Because the driver, it's a dangerous occupation, the driver to drive with his head out under those conditions. And he can't see a great deal, certainly not with the telescope, and even with his head out, he could have been to the screen with you. So we headed back, and it was quite dusk this time when we got along. We were heading back along the track to a place called Pila, where we were going to harbour for the night. Along this narrow track, it was still wet, it was eased off a little bit of rain, but it was miserably wet also. Along this track, Sergeant went first, corporal followed, and I saw the corporal's tank veer to the right a bit, and I thought, oh no, and he went a bit too far to the right, and it slithered over the edge of this track came up. So, of course, we all stopped, and I about got Sergeant got out and had a look at this tank. The only one thing to do was break the track, get the tank back on to level ground, get the track on it, and then pull the track over the track that we had come up after we'd broken it. We take the pins out, you see, to stretch it out along the tank, then turn it back over the track. Well, that took ages, as you can well imagine. In the darkness, pitch dark, wet, and on a narrow track. We had to get two tow ropes onto the tank to pull it up onto the track and onto a straight position so that we could run it forward along the track when we got that up. We managed it eventually, got the track back over the idlers and the sprocket, fastened it once again, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning we got back to the harbour area, soaked through. And we harboured by the little church just outside Pier. Well, we were really too tired to do anything. I think we had a can of beans to give us some, just a little bit of refreshment, cold, I think we had, if I remember right. And we then curled up in the tanks for the rest of the night, as I say, about 4 o'clock in the morning. We were all told the next morning that we were reserve squadron, we wouldn't be going out. So I just rolled up my tent, or my blanket, took a waterproof and rolled up on the porch of the church for a couple of hours' sleep. Even then it was a bit chilly and drafty, but at least it was reasonably dry under there. And by mid-morning we were back, cleaned up, tidied up, there, but still we were ready to move on. And that was our little episode of Peruga.
Now, I believe the corporal, the crew complained.
They did, yes. When we tidied up, we were ready to move out. Because you see, you never knew when you'd be ordered out. If there was a bit of a catastrophe, some squadron gets bashed, we'd be out to support them or to take over from them. So you always got ready to move. And while we'd got ready, we were sitting around chatting, and Corporal came over and said they got problems, that they couldn't manage another day with the officer in China, because he just went to pieces when the shelling started, and he imagined that he'd seen enemy infantry in the trees. Well, that I can understand, because he was not battle-hardened. And if you are watching areas where there are trees for any length of time, you begin to see or imagine trees start to move. And I think this has affected him. And he'd imagined that the trees were moving and there was infantry in there. Anyway, the problem was, what were we going to do? Because I could well understand their position. And as a crew commander, he was of little use to me under those circumstances. So I had a word with the squadron leader. And he was transferred to another squadron. And I had my sergeant back in place and another crew member to take his place. So I got my troop again with the sergeant and the corporal.
So what about this sergeant? Was it shell, bomb happy or
yes,
shell shell?
In this same situation, that was the next problem. After I sorted out the crew commander of the corporal's tank, I had a word with the sergeant because I realised that there were problems So again, there's another chap of the squadron leader, and he said, well, he said, he's due for sending him back. He said, we've had this problem with him before. He's a good chap while he's normal and while his situation isn't too strenuous. But when you get continuous shelling for a long period, very heavy, so he then moved back to the echelon for a while before moving back to a base unit.
So who replaced him?
I had my corporal made up to sergeant, and the sergeant, corporal who had been with me before for a short time, Corporal Swift, he came in as my corporal in the troop. So that was my standard troop from then on. Sergeant Wellsford, who had been corporal, and the Corporal Swift, they were my crew commanders. And as I say, Sergeant Wilson, who was the one who was bomb happy, he went back to echelon and then went to a rear area.
Now, another thing is, it's interesting because you had a replacement wireless operator in one of your troop tanks who didn't fit in. And this is quite interesting because the thing about how a crew have to work to live and work together.
Absolutely.
Could you tell us about that?
Yes. This was a chap who was brought in, and he was a good chap in action. There were no complaints whatever. He was a wireless operator and motor, and he was quite a good chap. But he was a peculiar chap when you were not in action. In a tank crew, you've got to work together, and a troop, you've got to work together. When you finish your day's action, you want a bit of food if you can. Well, you prepare things that you can all share out. Now, he was a loner in many respects, and he wanted his fifth share of what food there was to prepare himself. Well, we hadn't got facilities for everybody to prepare their own little bit of food. So the crew were very obliging in that they asked him what he would like, and they would all have the same thing, just to keep the peace, as it were. Well, we didn't want to get problems with them, the crew. But that wasn't the way he wanted it. He wanted his own. So I could see there was going to be friction. And that doesn't do the troop any good when you've got to work together, because everybody relies upon one another. And dissension within the troop, well, it doesn't work in the efficiency that I like. So I got him on one side, because the corporal mentioned this to me, and they said, did you have a word with him? I said, yes, of course I did. So I got him on one side, and I said, now, what's this I hear about your food problem? You don't seem to get on with the others. And they, why don't you want the food that they're prepared to have? people. So I'm sorry I'm a bit off, he said, but I like to have my own food and do what I want with it. I said, yes, but I said, that doesn't work in a troop. I said, when you've all got to live together in a steel box, you've all got to get on well together, you've got to prepare to work with the rest of the troop and not be an individual. I said, when you're on your own, in certain circumstances, in other units, then that's possible, but not in tanks. Well, he said, I'm sorry, but I'll try and work with the troop in the future. I said, well, look, I said, if you want to transfer, I'll try and get you a transfer. But if you can work with the troop, I'm quite prepared to accept you as you are, and I hope you'll find a way of agreeing with the other chapter of the troop. Well, he did. I must say, he tried, and he did fit in. Not that I have anything against a chap being what I would call a loner, but he did fit in very well towards the end, and he seemed to get on better, and they accepted him, and there were no problems from that day onwards. And he did, I will say, he did very well, but sadly he was not the loner.
So the next thing I'd like to talk about is the June 20th, is the advance into a bottleneck gap in the Corsiano.
Corsiano.
If you could set the scene, because it's quite a complex thing, in your book it's quite complex, and I think, you know, as to get in a picture of what's actually going on.
Well, it was complex right from the word go, because we were B squadron, we were reserve squadron on this advance. A squadron were ordered to take Corsiano. We were moving north and we got to find a way, an open road, so we could progress along this open road. There were two or three minor roads that they were aiming to use one of them. A squadron were ordered to go along this track to a little village called Corsiano. We were reserve. And we listened in to the radio of A Squadron as they moved forward. A Squadron went along this track, and we could only picture it from the map. As they went along, they got to the area that I call the bottleneck, which was the gap in the hills along a rising crest, where it turned left and went between a gap in the ridge. It was a narrow gap, and across the valley was the village of Corsiano. A squadron got as far as the gap. Two tanks went through, and the third tank was just in the gap. All three were knocked out in quick succession, one after the other. Obviously, the German gunners, I would imagine would be a tank on the other side near the village, let the two come through because they could pick them off. One, two, and the third in the gap. Well, that was the end of A Squadron. We heard A Squadron would be withdrawn, and I knew what was coming up then. B Squadron would take over. And my gun said to me, "You know that for now?" And I said, "Yes." And that meant B Squadron would take over from A Squadron and force the gap and take Corsiano. So we headed up along this narrow track, and it was a narrow track, a dirt track, and it was quite a long one, maybe 400 or 500 yards, I would think. And then it swung left to the gap, and as we got on the track, we could see it, and I could see something in the corner there. We couldn't make out what it was. And the A Squadron, the two tanks of A Squadron, were the young chaplain, Bob Crichton, who was the troop leader, he stopped by me, and I said, "Can you tell me what's going on up there? What's it like?" He said, it just hell up there. He said, "Best of luck to you, George." Shook hands and disappeared. And I thought it was a bit like a fond farewell, that was. So we went up. He said, "There's three tanks up there already knocked out." So we got up to the corner. But as we went up, a shell came from that corner. I could see a cloud of dust arise. Now that meant to me there was a muzzle brake firing, and the dust from the muzzle brake lifted, and I fired straight away. Two shots went off, and there was a bit of a red glow, and I thought, "Oh, there's something." No more shots came down, so we continued up, swung round the bend, And as this went on the bend, I could see the situation for what it was. Now, the regimental commander who was directing the operation had no idea what the situation was in the bend itself. And to me, there was no way anything was going to get past that knockdown tank and continue, because there was no other space. There was only space for one tank by the side of the knockout tank. On the left, there was a ploughed field with a very steep gradient, and it was so soft, it looked so soft, that a tank wouldn't get through it completely. So the sergeant was just in front of me. I said, pull off the road to the right. I said, nothing going to get through there without either covering fire or smoke. So I reported to the colonel at squadron headquarters, and he went through to the colonel. I said, nothing going to get through there. The gap is just the width of a tank. I said, there's a knocked-out tank there. Nothing going to get through. I said, we need covering fire or smoke. I'm going to get out and have a look over the crest to either find if we can take the road to the right, the track to the right, if we can get down to it, or we can get tanks into a position to get covering fire so that somebody will get through. He said, right, carry on. So I got permission to carry on. So I took the sergeant, we jumped out of our tanks and ran up this crest to the right to see if we could get over, or could we get the firing position to fire onto the village on the other side, just to distract their attention while the tank troop got through. We had just got up there to have a look over. We could see there was no way a tank would get down the front, so the next thing we'd come and see the village. At that moment, machine guns opened up. Now, where they were, I have no idea, but they whistled around all over the place. So I said to the sergeant, not going to get much from up here, we're not going to see very much, let's get down a bit lower and have a look around the front. We went down to a little gully that was there, away from the machine gun bullets, which spluttered down. We didn't get it, fortunately. And just as I got down, I saw two troop coming up. I thought, heaven help us, I can't wait for a minute. Two troop were ordered up, and as they came up, it got level with the tank on the road, and bang, that was knocked out. So I thought, oh no. So I'm afraid I got in the tank, and I said, two troops out. I said, there's nothing going to get through there. I said, as fast as we pull the tanks away, put another one in, they just knock them out. I said, they need smoke or out. Can you get artillery fire over? I said, there's no artillery available. I said, well, we'll see what we can do. He said, is there any other gap? I said, well, the only other gap is just to the left, through the plough field, and I don't think anything will make that. It's so soft and steep. And that again, as soon as it puts its nose over the crest, that'll go. Well, he said, right, see what position you can get. So at that moment, as the knockout tank of two troop started to blaze, the crew bailed out. They lifted the sergeant out who lost the leg, and he was left behind the tank while the others rolled and grasped. They got the uniforms on fire. They rolled on the grass to get the fire out and then ran off down the road. It must have been in considerable pain. The sergeant was lying there, so I said to my crew, I said, I'm going to get the sergeant in. So I went down, and he was lying behind the tank, about 5 or 8 yards behind the tank, and picked him up. He was in pain. He said, we'll have to get out of this, with the bloody thing, you want to go up, and we'll go up with it. I said, you're going to get a shot of morphine. So I gave him a shot and left the fellow on his battle dress. I said, it's going to be painful. So I lifted him up on my back, got his arms over my shoulder like a sack of coal. He was falling to me, and I'm afraid he swore rather as I dragged him along. His foot was dangling on the floor. And I got him down to my tank, and they sent the honey up for him. I asked him to get the honey up. And the honey came up, we got the sergeant on, and the secret, he was secret ordered up on the field.